I am Planta on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. The New York Times bestselling author Johan Hari joins me now. He's just published a new book, already getting a lot of attention in the United States and in Britain. It's called Lost Connections, Uncovering the Real Causes of Depression and the Unexpected Solutions. It's a provocative book, but one that's making a lot of sense for a lot of people around the world. It's around the world that Mr. Hari takes the reader. He goes to find that which social scientists are discovering works in the treatment of depression and anxiety. Johan Hari's own experience is that from a child suffering from depression, he's prescribed antidepressants. It's a chemical imbalance in his brain, he's told, and as he gets older, he decides to look into it all. His travels take him around the world, Baltimore, Indiana, Berlin, Vietnam, and many more places, including here in Vancouver. I'll get Mr. Hari to tell us about the solutions he's found that works, some that's medication, and a lot that's not. Johan Hari's book, Chasing the Scream, is being adapted into a feature film. He has won awards for his journalism and has written for numerous publications in the United Kingdom and the United States. He is a regular panelist on HBO's Real Time with Bill Maher. His TED Talk, Everything You Think That You Know About Addiction Is Wrong, has had over 20 million views. The Twitter handle is at JohanHari101. And the website for more is at thelostconnections.com. This new book is published by Bloomsbury. Please welcome to the Planta Online program, Johan Hari. Mr. Hari, good morning.
It's great to be with you, Joe. Thanks so much.
Thanks for joining us. So you know Vancouver well because you've been here many times, right?
Yeah, I spent a lot of time on the downtown east side for my previous book, which was about addiction, Chasing the Scream, and I love Vancouver. I'm not saying this just to suck up. You can check I say it when I'm not in Vancouver. It's a city, I think it's one of the interesting and important cities in the world.
Yeah, and I understand that you spent a lot of time with Bud Osborne, is that right?
Bud is one of the people I've most admired in my whole life. I think he's a, people who don't know, he lived on the downtown east side for a time as a homeless person with an addiction problem. He began an extraordinary movement, Vandu, for compassion and love for people with addiction problems. We had a lot of addiction in my family. And Bud's story, which I wrote about in Chasing the Scream, has inspired people all over the world. And I think he's one of the most remarkable people I ever knew.
Yeah, yeah. So a lot of people think we know depression and anxiety because it's so much around us, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, we all know. People know the figure in terms of you know, who has it and how it's being treated. When you were a teen, how did it manifest itself, and what did the doctor do for you?
It manifested as just a really deep sense of, like, pain was leaking out of me, and I couldn't control it, I couldn't regulate it, I didn't understand why I felt this way. So I went to my doctor eventually. I was in pain for a long time before I went. And I felt quite ashamed, I felt quite embarrassed. And my doctor told me a story. It was an entirely biological story about why I felt this way. He said, there's this chemical called serotonin in people's brains. Some people are naturally lacking it, you're clearly one of them. The only solution you need is that we're going to give you these drugs, and you're going to feel better. And I started taking chemical antidepressants, one that's known as Paxil in Canada. And I did feel a lot better for a time, for a couple of months. Then this sense of pain started to bleed back through. I went back to my doctor. He gave me another higher dose. Again, I felt better. Again, the pain came back through, and it kind of continued in this way. And one of the reasons I wrote my book, Lost Connections, Uncovering the Real Causes of Depression and the Unexpected Solutions, was there were these two mysteries kind of hanging over me. One was, why was I still depressed? I was doing everything our culture tells us to do when we're depressed, mm-hmm. and I still was in quite a lot of pain. And the second question, although I had been given some relief by the antidepressants, the second question was, why are there so many other people like me? Canada has one of the highest levels of antidepressant use in the world, but an even higher rate of depression and anxiety. Why are so many people around us? Why did it seem that throughout my lifetime, I'm 39 now, throughout my lifetime, depression and anxiety had been rising? So I ended up, to find the answers to these mysteries, going on a big journey. I went over 40,000 miles and I interviewed the leading experts in the world on what causes depression and anxiety and what solves them. And I realized I'd been making such a basic mistake. Until I went to my doctor when I was a teenager, I had thought that depression and anxiety were all in my head, meaning I was just weak, I needed to man up. Mm-hmm. Then for the next 13 years, I thought it was all in my head, meaning it was just a chemical imbalance in my brain. what I learned from interviewing the leading experts in the world is there are real biological factors that can make us more sensitive to this, but actually the causes are largely not in our heads. I learned there are 9 causes of depression and anxiety for which there is scientific evidence. 2 of them are biological, and 7 are factors in the way we live. And once you see this very different story about what's making us feel this way, it opens up a whole different set of solutions, ones that actually work in a more powerful way.
So for people listening to us who haven't picked up the book, I mean, antidepressants have a positive effect on a number of people. Is there a percentage, though, that don't need it, say? I mean, because it is over-prescribed and overused, could one, say, get a bunch of people off of them today?
I think the answer is a little bit nuanced. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's too simplistic to think in a pro or against way. So
yeah.
We know the effect that chemical antidepressants have. So depression is measured by something called the Hamilton scale. I've always felt sorry for whoever Hamilton was, that we only remember him by how miserable we all are. But anyway, the Hamilton scale goes from 1, where you would be dancing around in ecstasy or on ecstasy, to 51, where you would be acutely suicidal. To give you a sense of what movement on the Hamilton scale is like, if you improve your sleep patterns, you will gain 6 points on the Hamilton scale. If your sleep patterns get worse, say you have a baby, you will lose 6 points on the Hamilton scale. On average, according to the leading expert on this at Harvard Medical School, chemical antidepressants move people 1.8 points on the Hamilton scale. So it's important to say that's an average. Some people have more, some people have less. And it's important to say that's not nothing, right?
Yeah.
If you're acutely suicidal, 1.8 points may be what takes you off the bridge, right? That has real value. It takes the edge off the worst symptoms. But it doesn't solve the problem for most people. This is why a majority of people, I thought I was really weird for taking antidepressants and still being depressed. Actually, I was quite normal. And one of the people who really helped this to fall into place for me was when I went and interviewed a South African psychiatrist called Derek Sommerfeld. And Derek happened to be in Cambodia when chemical antidepressants were first introduced. And the Cambodian doctors didn't know where they were, so he explained. And they said, oh, we don't need antidepressants. We've already got antidepressants.
Uh-huh.
And he said, what do you mean? He thought they were going to talk about some kind of herbal remedy. Instead, they told him a story. There had been a farmer in their community who worked in the rice fields, and one day he stepped on a landmine and he got his leg blown off. So they gave him an artificial limb and he went back to work in the rice fields. But apparently it's extremely painful to work underwater when you've got an artificial limb. He, I imagine it was pretty traumatic. He's in the place where he was blown up.
Mm-hmm.
He began to cry all day, didn't want to get out of bed, classic depression. So they said, we gave him an antidepressant. Derek said, what did you do? They went and sat with him. They listened to him. They realized that his pain made sense. It wasn't just an irrational malfunction. They figured if they bought him a cow, he could become a dairy farmer. He wouldn't be in this situation of distress. They bought him a cow. Within a few weeks, his crying stopped. He was fine. They said to Derek, so you see, doctor, that cow was an antidepressant. That's what you mean, right?
Mm.
And what those Cambodian doctors knew intuitively is what the World Health Organization has been trying to tell us for years. Our pain makes sense. If you are depressed and anxious, you're not crazy. You're not a machine with a malfunctioning part. You're a human being with unmet needs. Everyone listening to this program knows that they have physical needs, right? You need food, you need water, you need shelter, you need warmth, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
If I took those things away from you, you would be in trouble really quickly. There's equally strong evidence that human beings have natural psychological needs, right?
Mm-hmm.
You need to feel you belong. You need to feel your life has meaning and purpose. You need to feel that you are valued and people see you. You need to feel you've got a future that makes sense. We have a culture that does lots of things really well, but our culture has been getting less and less good at meeting people's deeper psychological needs. And that's the key reason why we have this rising crisis of depression, anxiety, and addiction. It's not the only reason, but it's a key one.
Yeah, so who do we blame, or what do we blame for these connections that we might have had a generation ago that are now lost?
I don't know how much it helps to think about blame. I think it helps to think about solutions. But I'll give you an example. I notice that lots of the people I know who are depressed and anxious, their depression and anxiety focuses around their work. So I started to look at the evidence about how do people feel about their work. Gallup did a massive study in the United States, Canada, and most of the Western world to figure out how do people actually feel about their jobs. turns out 13% of us, 1-3%, like our work. We enjoy it most of the time. 63% of people are what they call sleepwalking through their work. Mm-hmm. Don't like it, don't hate it, they tolerate it.
Yeah.
24% of people hate their jobs, fear and dread them. So you think about that, 87% of people don't like the thing they're doing most of their waking lives. You're almost twice as likely to hate your job as love your job. And I started to think, could that have some relationship with the mental health and emotional crisis that we're having? So I began to look for evidence on this, and I discovered and interviewed an extraordinary Australian social scientist called Professor Michael Marmot, who discovered what causes depression at work. There are many factors, but he discovered the biggest. The core of what makes you depressed at work is if you go to work and you have no control or low control. So human beings have an innate need to feel that what we're doing has meaning. And if you're just controlled all the time, that obstructs your ability to create meaning. It makes you depressed. It actually makes you even more likely to have a stimulated heart attack.
Mm.
So what I learned is that there is an antidepressant for that, and it's the equivalent to the cow, right? It's about expanding our idea of what an antidepressant is. An antidepressant should be thought of as anything that reduces our depression and anxiety. And so we have to deal with that underlying cause. I went to Baltimore and met an extraordinary person called Meredith Keough. Meredith used to go to bed every Sunday night, just sick with anxiety, right?
Yeah.
She had an office job. It wasn't the worst office job in the world. She wasn't being harassed or anything. But she just couldn't bear the thought this was going to be the next 40 years of her life.
Mm-hmm.
So Meredith, with her husband Josh, did this quite bold thing. Meredith quit her job. Josh quit his job. Josh had worked in bike stores since he was a teenager. And, you know, it's kind of controlled work. It's low wage. It's insecure. And one day, Josh, with his colleagues in the bike store, had just said, what does our boss actually do? They liked their boss, but it seemed like they fixed all the bikes and he took all the money.
Mm-hmm.
They set up a bike store that worked on a different principle. It doesn't have a boss who controls the staff. It's a democratic cooperative. So the way it works is they take the big decisions together. They share the profits. They share out the good tasks and the less good tasks, so no one gets stuck just with the depressing jobs. And one of the things that was so striking there, completely in line with Professor Michael Marmot's work, is how many of them used to be depressed in their previous way of working but weren't depressed now. It's important to say, it's not like they quit their jobs fixing bikes and went to go and become Beyoncé's backing singers, right? They fixed bikes before they fixed bikes now.
Yeah.
They dealt with the thing that causes depression and anxiety at work, which is control. Now, lots of people will be listening and totally understand, be saying, well, I can't quit my job and do that.
Yeah.
And, of course, my relatives who are depressed can't quit their jobs and do that. What Lost Connections is about arguing, in part, there are things individuals can do, but it's about arguing that we need big social changes. Now, we could, as Josh said to me, there's no reason why any business should work in this way that causes depression and anxiety. Every corporation could be a democratic cooperative, right?
Yeah.
Imagine how differently people listening to this would feel if they knew that tomorrow they were going into a workplace where they set the priorities with their colleagues by voting, where if there has to be a boss, he's elected by them and accountable to them, where you can share out the tasks that make people miserable and the tasks that are enjoyable. That's a very different way of living. That is an antidepressant, right?
Now, how receptive do you think business and commerce would be to redoing what we know the workplace to be today?
Well, they would be as receptive as people were 30 years ago to the idea of gay marriage. They'd be extremely hostile. But when people band together and demand something better, firstly, that has itself an antidepressant effect. Just the act of saying, you know what, we're not crazy to feel bad. Actually, it's because our needs are not being met, we're not being treated well. Just the act of banding together to fight something better itself makes people feel better. The struggle is part of the solution. But, everyone listening, any woman listening to this knows, you know, your life is incalculably different to your mother's life, your grandmother's life, because women said, we're not going to put up with this.
Mm.
Any gay person listening to this knows that. I mean, so collective change happened. Of course, it's a fight, right? They're not going to, Frederick Douglass, the released slave, said, power never surrenders anything without a struggle. Now, there are lots of other solutions, other kinds of antidepressants for the causes of depression and anxiety that we can utilize. I'll give you another example.
Yeah.
We are the loneliest society there has ever been. Human beings evolved to live in hunter-gatherer tribes, right? You and I are alive and having this conversation for one reason. Our ancestors were really good at banding together and working together. They weren't bigger than the animals they took down, but they were better at cooperating, right? Every instinct human beings have is to be together as a tribe. we are the first humans to ever try to live without a tribe. There's a remarkable study in the United States that asked Americans, how many close friends do you have and you can call on in a crisis?
Mm.
When they started doing it years ago, the most common answer was five.
Mm-hmm.
Today, the most common answer is none. If you're on your own, you know, think about if you were on your own in the circumstances where we evolved, if you were separated from the tribe, you were depressed and anxious for a really good reason. You were about to be eaten, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Those are our instincts. So I wanted to look at what's an antidepressant for that. And I discovered this incredible man called Dr. Sam Everington. So he's a general practitioner in East London, where I'm from. As you can tell from my weird Downton Abbey accent, I'm British. and Sam was really uncomfortable because he had lots of patients coming to him with depression and anxiety. And yet he was being told to tell them, you've just got a chemical imbalance in your brain and you should just give them drugs. Now, like me, Sam's not opposed to chemical antidepressants. He's in favor of them in some circumstances. But he just thought, one of the things that struck him was how lonely his patients were. He said, this isn't solving their loneliness. This isn't dealing with the reason they feel bad. He decided to pioneer a different approach. A patient came to him called Lisa Cunningham, who I got to know. Lisa had been depressed and anxious for 7 years, shut away in her home, crippling anxiety. Sam said to her, don't worry, I'll carry on giving you the drugs, but I'm also going to prescribe something else. I'm going to prescribe for you to take part in a group. So he said there was an area of scrubland behind the doctor's surgery, and he said to Lisa, I'm going to turn up to help you, but what I'd like you to do is twice a week meet with a group of other depressed and anxious people, and we're going to turn this scrubland into something beautiful. First meeting, Lisa was literally physically sick, but
uh-huh.
The group keeps meeting. They taught themselves gardening. They had something to talk about that wasn't how terrible they felt.
Mm-hmm.
They got to know each other. They got to bond. As Lisa put it to me, as the garden began to bloom, we began to bloom. There was a study in Norway of a very similar program that found it was more than twice as effective as chemical antidepressants. I think the reasons are clear, because it was dealing with some of the reasons why they felt so bad in the first place.
Yeah.
Their disconnection from each other, their disconnection from the natural world. And in my book, Lost Connections, I go through seven kinds of antidepressant like that, that are about dealing with these deep underlying causes that we should be offering people alongside chemical antidepressants.
Yeah. I mean, it's so hard for those of us who are over 30 to meet new people, say. And,
totally.
And so what have you found useful in terms of, in terms of what works and in getting over that?
I think there's lots of things. One of the things I wanted to understand is why we've turned en masse to trying to talk to each other through screens rather than talking to each other face to face. I went to the first ever internet rehab center in the United States. It's in Spokane in Washington State.
Mm-hmm.
I've got to admit, when I arrived, it's a clearing in the woods. My first thing I did absolutely instinctively was look at my phone and feel really irritated. I had no cell phone reception and I couldn't check my email. I was like, oh my God, you should be in this place, right?
Yeah.
But what was so fascinating, so it was run by a woman called Dr. Hilary Cash, who's become a kind of expert on internet addiction, partly because she just happened to be a psychotherapist with an office next to Microsoft's offices in the 90s, so she saw the first wave of this.
Uh-huh.
And one of the things she explained to me that I thought was so interesting is if you look at, so a lot of, they get a whole range of patients, but a lot of them are young men. And she said, who are obsessed with, like, multiplayer role-player games, like
uh-huh.
World of Warcraft, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And she was like, what do these young men get out of these multiplayer role-player games? They get the things they used to get from the culture. They get a sense of tribe. They get a sense of identity. They get a sense of status and a way they can gain status. You know, there's incredible research in Britain, I think the figures would be similar for Canada, shows the average British child spends less time outdoors than the average maximum security prisoner, because by law a maximum security prisoner has to have, I think it's 70 minutes,
mm-hmm,
right?
Mm-hmm.
So these are kids who've grown up as prisoners in a profoundly lonely society. And I began to think that in a way, one of the reasons we've become obsessed with these ways of talking to each other is, you think about the moment they arrived in history. For most of us, things like email and the internet, late 90s, the early 2000s. And what happened is a lot of the factors that are driving up depression and anxiety were already in place.
Mm-hmm.
Massive increase in loneliness, for example. But what the internet does is it arrives and it looks a lot like the things we've lost. Right? You have status updates in place of status. You have Facebook friends in place of Facebook. But it doesn't, as Dr. Cash explained to me, it doesn't meet those deeper needs. In the same way, I began to think the relationship between social media and social life is a bit like the relationship between pornography and sex, right? I'm not against pornography, but, you know, it meets a certain basic itch. But if your entire sex life consisted of only looking at pornography, you would be constantly frustrated and irritated because your deeper needs would not be being met. In a similar way, if too much of your social life is mediated through screens, that's not what we evolved for, right? Now, we turn to it because it's filling a hole that the culture has left, but we have to deeply reconnect offline.
Yeah, and so are there things that you've done that have helped you, say, achieve that and maybe put the phone away for a bit?
Massively. One of the things that really interested me is I went to interview this woman called Dr. Brett Ford in Berkeley, who did this really interesting research. She wanted to figure out, if you try deliberately to make yourself happier, do you actually become happier? And they did this research in four countries, the United States, Taiwan, Russia, and China, right?
Yeah.
And Japan, not China.
Uh-huh.
And what they found was, in the United States, if you try to make yourself happier, you don't become happier. But in all the other countries, if you try to make yourself happier, you do. And they were like, what's going on? So they looked at this more. What they discovered is, in the United States, and I'm sure this would be true of Canada and Britain as well, if you try to make yourself happier, what you do is you do something for yourself most of the time. You try to get a promotion, you buy something for yourself, you big yourself up. In the other places, if you try to make yourself happier, you tend to do something for someone else, your friends, your family, your community. And it turns out our way of making ourselves happier, doing something for ourselves, just doesn't work. We're not that species, right? Mm. We're the species that evolved to cooperate all the time and to feel good when we were part of a tribe. So one of the things, I mean, as I say, I go through in Lost Connections, 7 solutions to depression and anxiety for which there's scientific evidence. One of them for me, some of them are big social changes, some of which were pioneered in Canada that I can talk about if you want.
Mm-hmm.
But for me, one of the biggest things was just, it used to be that when I felt this sense of pain coming on, I would do something to try to lift myself up by doing something for myself. Now what I do is I try to make myself, even if I really don't feel like it, go and do something for someone else.
Mm.
And we live in such a lonely and atomized society that just turning up, leaving your phone at home and listening to someone is the biggest gift you can give, right? Be present with other people. Even when you're starting to feel bad, you can almost always make someone else feel better. You don't have to turn up like Oprah with a free car for them. Just turn up with your attention. I don't know why that came into my head there. But, no. you turn up with your attention and your presence, and doing something for someone else will lift you up. It's, in fact, the best way to lift yourself up. It's one of the reasons why the Amish have the lowest level of depression in North America. So I went to spend time in an Amish community to figure out, well, what are they doing right that we're not doing right? There's a lot I disagree with the Amish on, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, they're present with each other all the time. They're not constantly talking to each other through screens. They have a very deep sense of meaning and connection.
You mentioned these travels that you've done, and for Lost Connections, you did talk to Dr. Gabor Maté here in Vancouver.
Great friend of mine. I love Gabor.
Yeah, I'm fascinated with the work though that Michael Chandler is doing at UBC.
Yeah, this really fascinated me. So, and obviously it's something that's being, and I interviewed him as well. So. Obviously something that's being debated in Canada quite rightly at the moment in light of this terrible thing that happened last week.
Yeah.
The acquittal of the man who killed the young
Colton Boucher, yeah.
Yeah. So Professor Chandler obviously knew that First Nations people have a scandalously high level of suicide, and he wanted to understand why. And he knew there were 196 First Nations groups in Canada, and he realized that some of them have very high suicide rates and some have no suicide at all. So he spent a really long time researching what's going on there, right? What explains this disparity? And it transpired that it's important to say this is not the only factor. There's as First Nations people can explain much better than me, there's a huge amount of intergenerational trauma. There's an extraordinary range of horrendous challenges that have been forced upon First Nations people who survived the genocide that Europeans, my ancestors and yours, imposed upon them. But one of the key factors that Professor Chandler found is some First Nations groups have regained control of their communities. They have, revived their language, they've regained control of their school system, all of those things. And some have been so kept down that they've not done that. And it turns out the suicide rate correlates very closely with the amount of community control that a group has, that a First Nations grouping has. And I think this has clearly really important lessons for First Nations people within Canada, and that's where it's primarily important. But I actually think it has incredibly huge lessons for the rest of us as well. Now, I don't want to take this analogy too far, because First Nations people have been exposed to unique and particularly terrible forms of violence and trauma, like the residential schools. But I think that principle applies much more widely. You know, I spent time in the Rust Belt, the areas that went for Trump in the run-up to the election, after interviewing Professor Chandler. And I kept thinking about those findings, right? I remember being on a street in Cleveland. It's one of those devastated parts of Cleveland where, you know, a third of the houses are abandoned, a third have been demolished, and a third still have people living in them. We knocked on one door, and there was a woman who I would have guessed from looking at her was 60. I found out she was the same age as me, 39.
Oh.
And, you know, she was very articulate, very angry, and she made this verbal slip that I'll never forget. She was talking about what the area used to be like when, you know, people like her parents and grandparents could, you know, leave school at 16 and have good jobs that paid a middle-class income.
Yeah.
And she said, she talked about what the area used to be like. She meant to say, when I was young.
Yeah.
What she actually said is, when I was alive.
Mm.
And it really hit me. That's how a lot of people feel in our culture. And it's not surprising that correlates with higher levels of depression, anxiety, addiction, suicide. But actually, one way back from this was really pioneered here in Canada. One experiment in Lost Connections, I think, is really remarkable, actually. So in the 1970s, the Canadian government chose a town here in Canada, seemingly at random. It's a town called Dauphin.
Mm.
It's about 4 hours out of Winnipeg.
Yeah.
And they said to a huge number of people in this town, from now on, we're going to give you the equivalent of $15,000 in today's money, US dollars, a year, in monthly installments. There is nothing you have to do in return for this, and there is nothing you can do that means we're going to take this away from you. We just want you to have a good life. We're giving you this money because you're a citizen of our country, right? And this was then studied to see, well, what would happen. And loads of interesting things happened, and major research on this has been done by Dr. Evelyn Forget, who I interviewed.
Mm-hmm.
But to me, the most interesting result is there was a really significant fall in depression and anxiety.
Mm.
In fact, depression and anxiety that was so severe that people had to be hospitalized fell by 9% in just 3 years. That's a remarkable fall. And I think that tells you something really important. It's related to what I think Professor Chandler discovered, which is this insecurity about the future that's been created across our culture. People don't feel they have a sense of what the future will be like. If they don't feel they have stable ground on which to stand, giving them back that sense of security, not in a false nostalgic way, in the kind of Trump way, which is, you know, the fantasy that they're going to start manufacturing iPhones again in Indiana. They're not. But we all know that's not going to happen.
Yeah.
But there is a way to restore security to people. And as Dr. Forget said to me, the expert on that experiment, that's an antidepressant, right?
Yeah.
It reduces people's depression and anxiety.
Yeah. I think it's in Howard's End, the line from E.M. Forster,
yeah.
Only connect. What did he mean by that?
I actually think people misunderstand what Forster said about that. I love E.M. Forster, Lost Connections is all about the connections we have lost to really meaningful and deep things, to a sense of purpose, to a sense of community, to a sense of the future. I can go on. And that these are driving up these epidemics of despair across our culture. I think Forster was such an expert on connection because he found it, he was in a situation where he was denied connection. He was a gay man in a society where he would have gone to prison if he tried to be openly gay. He had real trouble forming relationships. And he kind of understood that, you know, connection is hard, right? It's a really deep need that we have, but it's hard. And to really live a connected life is a challenge, but it's the greatest reward that you can get as a human being. And I think what we've had, see, the problem with what I was told by my doctor, right? When I went to my doctor as a teenager with depression, what I was told was it's just a problem in your brain. Now, it's important to say there are real biological causes, like your genes, that can make you more sensitive to the problems we're talking about. And they are two of the connections that I write about, two of the causes of depression and anxiety that I write about in Lost Connections. But if you tell an entirely biological story, what you do is you cut people off from finding out the reasons, the factors that are making them depressed and anxious in their lives, and from us dealing with them together. Imagine, think about that example of the guy in Cambodia who was given the cow.
Mm-hmm.
Imagine if he had just been told, yes, it's just a problem in your brain, and you just need to fix it with drugs. He would still be depressed, right? Might have taken a bit of the edge off it.
Mm-hmm.
He would still be depressed. So we need to deal with these deeper causes, and it's interesting how there are many good psychiatrists and many great, actually Canadian psychiatrists like Professor Lawrence Kiermaier, who I interviewed in Montreal, who were very alert to this, but it's been interesting to see how hard it is for this overwhelmingly biological model of psychiatry to deal with this. I stress again, there are loads of really good psychiatrists who agree with what I'm talking about, but something was discovered in the 1970s by psychiatrists that was so inconvenient that it was brushed aside. It couldn't be handled. So in the 70s, American psychiatrists, the American Psychiatric Association, decided for the first time they were going to standardize how depression is diagnosed. So they drew up a checklist of 10 symptoms, things like crying all the time, obvious stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And they sent them out to psychiatrists, and they said, if people show more than 5 of these symptoms for more than 2 weeks, you should diagnose them as mentally ill and do what you can, right?
Yeah.
So they send out this list of symptoms. But what happened was, after a while, psychiatrists came back and said, look, we've got a bit of a problem here. If we use this checklist, we should be diagnosing every grieving person in the United States as depressed, because these are the symptoms of grief, right?
Mm, yeah.
So the psychiatrists get back together, the APA, and they basically said, we've got this wrong. And they created something called the grief exception. They said, use this checklist to diagnose people as depressed unless they've lost someone they love in the past year, in which case it doesn't count.
Mm.
So they start using that. But this led to a really awkward conversation, because suddenly psychiatrists are saying to people, okay, depression is just a brain disease, and it should just be diagnosed using a checklist. But there's one situation in life where that's not the case. There's one situation where this is an understandable response. But that begs the question, why is that the only situation where it's an understandable response? Why is it only understandable if someone you love has died? Why not if you've lost your home?
Yeah.
Why not if you've lost your job? Why not if you're stuck in a job you hate for the next, 30 years, right? Once you admit that depression can be a response to life, that requires a totally different kind of conversation, one that's all about context, one that's largely about the way we live. But that was such an that will require such a system overhaul in how we currently think about mental health,
mm-hmm.
that the American Psychiatric Association just got rid of the grief exception. It doesn't exist.
Mm-hmm.
So now, if your child dies at 10 a.m., as Dr. Joanne Cacciatore, the leading expert on this, has shown, you could be diagnosed that day as mentally ill if you're showing all these symptoms of distress. But I think it tells us something really important, that grief and depression have the same symptoms, because I think what depression is grief for your own life not going how it should. It's grief for your own needs not being met.
Mm.
And when someone we love dies, all we can do is hold and support the people who survive. But when your own needs are not being met, when you're grieving for that, well, we can intervene to help people to get their needs met, and that is that will be the thing that gives them relief from that grief, that depression.
Yeah. I could talk all day with you about this book. Because,
thank you so much.
Yeah, but before you go, you've traveled to the United States promoting it. Has the reception there, has that surprised you?
It's been unbelievably moving. I got a letter from Hillary Clinton saying she thought the book was wonderful.
Right.
A bizarre mixture of people approached me. Tucker Carlson, who is the top-rated host on Fox News,
yeah.
a world away from Hillary Clinton, and you can probably guess a world away from me,
right.
has raved about the book. People from Elton John to Russell Brand to Naomi Klein have been unbelievably positive. The book completely sold out on Amazon and is just being restocked now. I think a lot of people know and can see that something's not right about what we've been doing about depression.
Right.
For the last 30 years, we've been saying it's just a biological problem and only responding to it as a biological problem. And every year we've done that, the depression and anxiety crisis has got worse, right?
Mm-hmm.
At some point, we have to do what the World Health Organization, the leading medical body in the world, has been trying to get us to do for years, which is to see this has deeper causes. It has deeper roots in the way we're living. and we need to deal with it at that level, at the level at which we're living.
Yeah. Johan, I appreciate your time today. This is an important book, an important subject as well, that with your book you've given a lot of people a chance to talk about it. Thanks for this, and safe travels.
Oh, thank you so much. And I should say, can my publishers tell me off if I don't, that anyone who wants any more information about the book can go to www.thelostconnections.com, where they can take a quiz to see how much they know about the real causes of depression and anxiety. They can listen to audio of loads of the people I interviewed who we've been talking about all through this interview, and they can find out what Hillary Clinton and loads of other people have said about the book.
Thanks for this, Johan.
Thanks again. Cheers. Oh, I really enjoyed that. Thank you so much.
The book is called Lost Connections, Uncovering the Real Causes of Depression and the Unexpected Solutions. It's published by Bloomsbury. Thelostconnections.com is the website for more. Johan Hari joined me on the line from here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plata.